One black night, from the dome of City Hall, I saw Baltimore burn. I shall never forget that sight. Few persons have ever been privileged to look down upon a populous city and watch as its very heart was eaten out. It was a terribly harrowing experience to look, 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 and know that there was no force to stay the flames, that thousands of human beings must stand impotent and hopeless while myriads of hot red tongues withered everything in their path. We're on the record. I'm Sheila Cast, recounting the words of City Librarian Wilbur F. Coyle's description of the Great Fire of 1904, which raged in Baltimore from February 7th through the 8th. His account was published in the Baltimore Sun on February 29th, 1920. The fire spread across 80 blocks of downtown. It burned for 30 hours and destroyed 1,500 buildings. The blaze could be seen as far as Maryland's eastern shore as out-of-state fire departments battled flames alongside Baltimore's firefighters. In its wake, the fire left 35,000 Baltimoreans out of work. But the city rebuilt, and the devastation became an opportunity for improvement. Historian Wayne Schomburg is an expert on the Great Baltimore Fire of 1904. He joins me to talk about how the fire changed Baltimore and where you can see its impact today. Welcome to On the Record, Wayne.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
I suspect many of our listeners have heard the folklore of what ignited the Chicago Fire of 1871, right. Mrs. Leary's cow knocking over a lantern while being milked. The real cause remains undetermined. How did the fire in Baltimore begin?
Well, we're pretty much in the same boat here because the story I'm going to tell you is what we think happened, but we have really no solid proof that it did. And what we're talking about is the company where the fire started was the John E. Hearst Company. It was a wholesale dry goods company located about where the arena, or I still call it the Civic Center, Hopkins Place and Baltimore Street. And back in those days, and you can still, if you know where to look in Baltimore today, you can still find these buildings' basements extended out under sidewalks. So what companies would do to provide light for that part of the building, they would put in an iron plate in the sidewalk that had little glass eyes. And this would provide sunlight down into that part of the basement. Well, the thing is, these sidewalk vault lights is what they were called. People walk on them all day long. And in many cases, eventually the glass eyes would break and you would have a hole there instead of a glass eye. And the speculation is that Saturday night, February 6th, somebody walking down Hopkins Place with a cigarette or a cigar flicked it away, and just by chance, the thing rolled, fell through the hole into the basement, ignited what was down there, and then the fire smoldered all night long until it set off the internal alarm Sunday morning.
It was about 10:48 that the alarm came in.
When the alarm came in.
The scope of the fire was enormous.
Yes.
How quickly did it spread? How did it spread?
Well, it started with the Hearst building, and the firemen showed up. The fire company was right around the corner, so they were there in just minutes. And they pried open the front door. They went across, looked down in the basement, and of course the fire is going across the basement and then going up the elevator shafts. Now, if you remember back in those days, elevator shafts weren't enclosed. A lot of times they had fancy grill work around them. If you've ever been to an old hotel in Europe, you see this kind of thing. And so the smoke was rising up the elevator shaft. The Captain Call, who was in charge, he said later on, the one thing that we recognized right away, it sounded like doors were slamming on floors above us. And that's when he realized the fire had been burning since the night before and was pretty much starved for oxygen. Well, when those boys opened the front door, they let in air, and he realized it right away and pulled his men out just in time to avoid great injury when the building exploded. It's what you and I would think today of a backdraft, if you ever saw the movie Backdraft kind of thing. It's technically a smoke explosion, which firemen can explain much better than I can. But what happened was when the building exploded, it blew off the roof in all directions, blew out all the windows, and debris of roof went all over the intersection. So this happened just around 11 o'clock. Within 15 minutes, instead of one building on fire, you had seven buildings on fire. And that's the trigger to the Great Baltimore Fire.
Within 15 minutes, it had spread.
Within 15 minutes. Now, the wind at the beginning of the fire was coming from the southwest. So the fire originally was blown from this corner toward the corner of Charles and Baltimore Streets. By 7 p.m., The wind shifted again and blew west to east, and the wind speed picked up to 20 to 25 miles an hour. By midnight, we had a frontal passage through Baltimore, and the winds now were coming from the northwest at almost 30 miles an hour. So this fire was literally blown west to east across downtown Baltimore and blown basically across the roofs of buildings. So what would happen is the roof would catch on fire, collapse into the upper floor, which would then catch on fire, and the buildings were burning top to bottom. And that's one of the things that made the fire so difficult to deal with, because Baltimore City had the state-of-the-art fire department at the time. We've got 25 fire companies, 460 firemen. We've got all the equipment, but the standard pumping engine that you see, the old-time pumper, could push water up maybe five stories. Well, if your building was five stories or less, you're good. But many downtown buildings were higher than five stories. So as a result, as the wind's blowing the fire roof to roof to roof, these buildings are catching on fire, and the firemen can't really do anything about it. So as they begin to burn, and eventually you see a lot of buildings collapsing because the upper floors are just falling into the lower floors. The other issue was Baltimore City streets back in 1904 were very narrow. Many of them were maybe 45, 50 feet wide, which enabled the fire to jump blocks to frustrate the firemen even when they're trying to
jump across the street.
Yeah, they're trying to get in front of the fire to beat it back. But of course, it's jumping block to block to block.
Over their heads.
So it really is. It's the fact that the fire itself simply outstripped the existing technology of the time to deal with a big urban fire.
At what point did Baltimore officials realize they had such a big problem they needed to ask for help from other cities?
Within the 15 minutes of the Hearst building going up, the fire chief, whose name was George Horton, who lived down by the Shot Tower, got on the scene and noticed this fire now with seven buildings going. And around 11:45, he sent a runner. And that's the other thing you got to remember, the technology of the day, no walkie-talkies, no cell phones. So he had to send a runner back to City Hall to get them to, that's where the fire department headquarters were, and then sent out the first message to Washington. And it was a very simple message: big fire here, must have help at once. So Washington was the first city to send us aid. And by the time the fire was over, we had over 770 out-of-town firemen fighting this blaze.
And were they actually able to do much?
Not a whole lot. One of the issues, one of the famous stories of the Baltimore fire, is that when the Washington companies got here and they put them on a train from D.C., they made the run in 38 minutes, which was 2 minutes short of the record. So those of you that ride the Camden line, ask the conductor if they can get to Washington the next time in 38 minutes. They'll throw you off the train. But anyway, they got here in quick time, offloaded their equipment. They were told where to go, what intersection. And the problem was when they got there, the hydrants are there, but their hoses could not hook up to the hydrants because in all the years fire equipment had been made in this country, nobody had thought about a standardized hose connection. Now, that would happen after the Great Baltimore Fire. So essentially, their hoses were completely unusable, but they simply went in and joined wherever they needed help and fought the fire.
That's historian Wayne Schomburg here on The Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the Great Baltimore Fire of 1904. The 114th anniversary of the fire is coming up on February 7th. What finally stopped the fire?
It's an amazing story, because it's a water body in Baltimore that has been hated for years and years. The Jones Falls saved Baltimore.
How?
And what had happened was, as the course of the fire went from headed northeast, then went east, and then went south, by Monday morning, the fire had worked its way down to Pratt Street. And now is working its way across East Pratt Street from Light Street. So the piers, the old piers that were on Pratt, all went up in the fire. And the issue is that just east of the Jones Falls, you're at Little Italy. And in fact, the night the fire was going, there was many a father and son up on those little row house roofs putting out embers. And that was a whole nother issue to the fire, the flying embers. Putting out embers, you know, have a bucket of water and a mop. But as the fire now begins to get close, Little Italy basically packs up and they start moving out. So the problem now is the fire is working east across Pratt Street, and the firemen realized that they could use the falls was about 80 feet wide as a fire break. So essentially they lined up their equipment on the bridges that went across the Jones Falls and on the east side of the falls, and the attempt was to beat the fire back and prevent it from jumping the falls, because one fireman said if it crosses the falls, it could burn all the way to the countryside. So that was their strategy. And the good news was by lunchtime, the wind began to die down. So they were a couple of times it would breach the east side of the falls, and they were able to put it out very quickly. But by dinner time, they had it under control Monday. Yeah, by dinner time Monday, they had it under control. Not out, but under control. So God bless the Jones Falls is basically the story there.
How long did it take to clear the rubble and debris?
Yeah, that's a great story, too, because within a week, the mayor, Mayor McLean, who was 36 years old, he's the youngest mayor Baltimore ever had, had begun to call business leaders and city leaders together and form what became known as the Burnt District Commission. And so they begin to form a plan for the rebuilding. And the first job was to remove this enormous pile of debris. Now, in the fire, and I think you mentioned 35,000 Baltimoreans lost their jobs. So many of them went to work because the first thing I had to get the debris out of the way in order to rebuild. They put debris wherever they could put it. It was all over the city. It was dumped in the harbor. And every so often, you hear a strange story in the Sun about somebody fishing something out of the harbor that was a bottle from a business or whatever. They simply put it wherever they could. And that was an enormous, enormous job before they could even begin to rebuild.
Of the 1,500 businesses that were destroyed in the fire, did most of them rebuild?
That's a good question. I've never really seen a percentage. A lot of them did, but a good number of them were family-owned businesses that were simply wiped out, and they decided not to rebuild. Many of the big companies, for instance, the Hearst Company, where the fire started, they rebuilt. What's interesting is, in the wake of the fire, of course, you know, businesses still want to conduct business, and of course, their building is gone. They opened up the 5th Regiment Armory and provided companies with a table and a couple of chairs. And that's how business was being conducted in Baltimore.
An incubator.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And again, banks were in the same, were in really a tough position. Savings Bank of Baltimore, which is one of the oldest banks, and people remember the Savings Bank, they had more accounts than any other bank in the city. So the city government opened the courthouse and for the Savings Bank of Baltimore to conduct business. Now, the other amazing thing about the banks is 20 banks burned in the Great Baltimore Fire. One of the first one was right around the corner from where the fire started. And of course, when people heard the fire was going on, of course, what they thought they were going to do is rush down to the bank and get their valuables or whatever. But, you know, most people know bank vaults are on time locks. So once you lock them Friday, they're locked till Monday morning. So they had to wait until the vaults cooled down before opening them up. But the amazing story is 20 banks burned, all 20 bank vaults held. Not a single penny was lost in the Great Baltimore Fire.
So one thing that was well designed going into this fire were bank vaults.
Day. You're exactly right.
And the rebuild was seen as an opportunity to make changes.
Oh, yeah.
To avoid impacts of fires in the future.
One of the things that was interesting was, you know, it certainly is an economic disaster for the city, but for an urban planner, this is a chance to correct a lot of the ills that affected Baltimore. So they were able to widen streets. Another thing is Baltimore was in the midst of putting in sewage systems by the turn of the 20th century. So this was a chance to put in the rest of the sewage system for downtown Baltimore and the storm drain system, which is still what carries water off the streets of Baltimore today. So that was all taken care of. Baltimore was the first big modern city to have a blaze. Now, Chicago, of course, had one in 1871, but many of the buildings in Chicago were wooden. Baltimore didn't have any wooden buildings. We're a modern 20th century brick, cast iron, stone facades. So Baltimore became a laboratory, and within weeks of the fire, most architects, engineers, building designers descended on Baltimore to see, okay, what worked, what didn't work in terms of construction. One of the buildings at Calvert and Baltimore Street, the Continental Trust Building, which is still there today, was designed by Daniel Burnham, the great Chicago architect. And it was put up in 1901, and it burned in the fire, and Burnham came to Baltimore within a couple of weeks of the blaze, inspected the building and said, the building is solid. It's done what it was supposed to be. And the building was steel frame encased in concrete. Those buildings are the ones that survived the fire in Baltimore. Other ones don't.
Did the fire claim any lives?
For many, many years, and Hal Williams, who wrote for the Baltimore Sun, wonderful writer, really did the first book on the fire in 1954. And up to that point, one of the famous statistics of the fire was, well, nobody had died in the fire. However, when we got to the centennial in 2004, historians and writers had a lot more access to documents Hal Williams would have never seen. And we discovered there were deaths in the fire. There were two during the course of the fire. One gentleman who was on one of the piers and was burned to death, and another gentleman who was trying to get records out of his business, and they were in the midst of dynamiting buildings and had a heart attack. So two people dying during the fire, and that's the lucky end of this fire. There's such a thing as luck, is it was on Sunday. If this had been during the week, it would have been a whole different story. So two lost during the fire and five deaths after the fire. And the five deaths after the fire were firemen and National Guardsmen, because the Maryland National Guard was called out Sunday night. And once the fire was over, they camped in tents on Baltimore Street all the way to the last week in February. These guys were on the streets of Baltimore. Three of the guardsmen died from pneumonia. Two of the Baltimore firemen also died of pneumonia. And the one, and I can't think of his name, there was an obituary when he died. And his mom said that when he came home Tuesday morning, he was absolutely soaked from the fire, from all the water that was going on. And he caught pneumonia and died in February. So altogether, if you count everything, it's about seven deaths in the Baltimore fire, but only two were actually during the course of the blaze.
Besides coming to hear you speak, you've got two events coming up that I'll mention in a minute. What resources do you recommend for people who want to learn more about the Great Baltimore Fire?
Two really good books. The first one is Hal Williams' book called Baltimore Fire. It was written in 1954 and then was revised a couple of other times. I would tell your listeners, every library in the state's probably got a copy of Hal Williams' book, because it was written on the 50th anniversary of the fire.
And it's called?
Baltimore Afire. And people remember Hal Williams because for years he was the editor of the Sunday Sun magazine. Great writer. So then we get to the 100th anniversary of the fire, and a professor down at Hopkins by the name of Dr. Pete Peterson wrote the 100th anniversary book, which is called The Great Baltimore Fire. It's a very simple title, published by Hopkins. And when I do talks, I always hold the two books up and say, Hal Williams had so much less material to look at, whereas Pete had, of course, the computer and the internet, and he could look at records Hal Williams could never see. But those are the two best books on the fire, and they're readily available.
Thanks for telling us about it.
You're welcome.
Historian Wayne Schomburg will speak about the Great Baltimore Fire of 1904 at two events in coming weeks. On Sunday, February 4th, at historic Old Otterbein United Methodist Church in Baltimore. And on Sunday, February 11th, at the Fire Museum of Maryland in Lutherville. We have links to those events and to Wayne Schomburg's website, all at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. Quick break on the record. I'm Sheila Cass. When we come back, a Stoop story.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.